Nobody was at reception when Knox came downstairs. The visitor's book lay open on the counter. He riffled the pages idly, seeking his previous visit. A Manchester address caught his attention. His old address. But the name wasn't his, not any longer. The names were those of his wife and the man. It took him a moment to realize they must have been married by then. So the man's name had been Tooley, had it? Knox hadn't cared to know. He was pleased to find that he felt nothing but curiosity. Why had she returned here? For a kind of second honeymoon? To exorcise her memories of him? When he emerged, it was raining. Above the hotel, mist wandered among the pines, which grew pale and blurred. High on the scree slope, the promontory known as the Bishop of Bath protruded like a single deformed tooth. The sight seemed to halt time, to turn it back. In a moment, Wendy would run out, having had to go back for her camera or her rucksack. I wasn't long, was I? The bus hasn't gone, has it? Oh dear, I'm sorry. Of course, these impressions were nonsense. He'd moved on, developed since the end of his marriage, defined himself more clearly. He strode down the Keswick Road. Looking up, he wondered where Wendy and the man had died. Mist had caught them high on the fells. They died of exposure. That much he'd heard from a friend of Wendy's, who had seemed to blame him for entrusting Wendy to an inexperienced climber. Now he was passing a camp in a field. He hadn't slept in a tent since early in his marriage. Rain slithered down bright canvas. The muffled voices of a man and a woman seemed to move with him from tent to tent. He peered between the tents to glimpse them, but the camp looked deserted. Everyone must be under canvas or walking. By the time he reached Braithwaite village, the rain had stopped. Should he climb Grisdale Pike? He remembered the view from the summit of Braithwaite and Keswick, the colours of pigeons, white and grey amid the pallet of fields. But other climbers were toiling upward. Suppose the height, when he reached it, was occupied by a class of children heading like lemmings for the edge. He'd go back to Bath. That would be lonely. Returning through the village, he passed Braithwaite post office. A postcard came fluttering down the garden path to his feet. Was that a stamp on its corner, or a patch of moss? He thought he recognized the handwriting, but whose did it resemble? A breeze turned the card like a page. Where a picture might have been, there was a covering of moss which looked vaguely like a blurred view of two figures huddled together. The card slid by him into the gutter and fell between the bars of the drain. He returned the way he'd come. The voices still wandered about the deserted campsite, though now they sounded distant and echoing. Their words remained inaudible, but they seemed to be calling a name through the tents. Back at Thornthwaite, as Knox glanced towards his hotel, Wendy appeared in his bedroom window. Of course, it was a chambermaid. But the shock reverberated through him, for all at once he realized that he was staying in the room which he had shared with Wendy. Memories surged, disconcertingly vivid. He decided to spend the afternoon in walking. The beginning was easy. Soon he was climbing beside Beckstone's Gill. But the path grew steep. Was it here that Wendy had run ahead, mocking his slowness? Around him, larches swayed numerous limbs, engrossed in their tethered dance. His breath rasped. He was uncomfortably aware of his pulse. He stumped upward over the path of scattered slate. On both sides of him, ferns protruded from decay. A small rock face blocked the path. His foot slipped. He slithered, banging his elbow, clutching for handholds. Thank heaven someone was coming. He could hear voices above the stream's rush that obscured them. He sat and cursed his pounding heart. He cursed aloud. He didn't care who heard him. But perhaps nobody did, for the owners of the voices never appeared. He struggled upward. How far had he still to climb? He must have labored half a mile by now. The forest had grown oppressive. He was sweating, and the clammy chill of the place failed to cool him. He could hear only the restless creaking of trees. All at once he yearned to reach the open. He felt suffocated. He forced himself onward, panting harshly. Suddenly pain halted him. Pain that transfixed his heart and paralyzed his limbs with shock. His head felt swollen, burning, deafened by blood. Beyond that uproar, were there voices? Could he cry for help? But he felt that he might never draw another breath. As suddenly as it had attacked him, the pain was gone. He slumped against a rock. Oh God, the doctor had been right. He must take things easy. The path felt distant and vague. He reached the edge of the forest without further mishap. Beyond it, Beckstone's gill rushed over broken stones. He crossed the stream and climbed the path. Below him, the heathery slope plunged towards the small valley. His face had turned cold as ice in the wind. He'd lost all sense of time before he reached the summit, where he halted, entranced. At last his toil had meaning. The world seemed laid out for him. Light and shadow drifted over the fells. They glowed with all the colors of foliage, grass, heather, except where vast tracts of rock broke through. He had to blink. Was he weeping, or had the wind stung his eyes? He couldn't tell. He watched light advancing through Beckstone's plantation, possessing each successive rank of foliage. Which lake was that on the horizon? He'd never before noticed it. It lay like a fragment of slate, framed by two fells, dark as storms. But above it, clouds were opening. The lake seemed to glow from within, intensely calm. Beyond it, fields and trees grew clear, minute and luminous. Yes, he was weeping. For a while he sat on a rock. But he must go down shortly, deep into the tangled forest. Suddenly it all frightened him. He couldn't tell why. He felt unsafe. Perhaps it was the mass of cloud which had closed overhead like a stone lid. The colors of the summit had turned lurid, threatening. He headed back towards the wood. The faces of grazing sheep gleamed like bone. He had never noticed before how they resembled munching skulls. A group of heads, chewing mechanically, glared white against the sky and kept their gaze on him. He was glad to cross the stream, though he couldn't feel the water. He must hurry down before he grew colder. The hush of the woods embraced him. Had a sheep followed him? No, it was only the creak of a decaying trunk. He slipped quickly down the path, which his feet seemed hardly to touch. The movement of silver-green lattices caged him. Branches and shadows swayed everywhere, entangled. The tips of some of the firs were luminously new. Wind stalked the depth of the forest, the trees like great vague forms on creaking stilts. The smell of growth and decay accompanied him. When he grabbed a branch to make sure of his footing, it broke, scattering flakes of lichen. The forest grew too vivid. The trees seemed victims of the processes of growth. Wherever he looked, it all seemed unbearably intricate. How, among all that, could he glimpse initials? Somehow they'd seized his attention before he knew what they were. They were carved on a cracked and wrinkled tree. Wendy's initials. And the man's. Of course she and the man might well have climbed up here. But the more Knox squinted, the less clear the letters seemed. He couldn't recapture the angle of vision at which they'd looked unmistakable. Perhaps they were only cracks in the bark. He glanced ahead for the path, and with a shock realized that it was not there. Nor was it visible behind him, as far back as the wall of gathering mist. Surely the path couldn't be far. He must press on and try to head downward. If only he'd gone back to the hotel for his whistle and compass. But there was a sound. Something was blundering towards him. As it tumbled through the mist, Knox suppressed an urge to run. He saw the object stagger against a misty root and collapse there. Then he saw that it was only a rucksack. Yet he couldn't quite feel relieved. The rucksack was old, discolored, and patched with decay. Where had it come from? Who had abandoned it, and why? It still moved feebly, as though inhabited. Of course, there was a wind. Nevertheless, he preferred not to go closer. The blurred, tentative movements of the overgrown sack were unpleasant somehow. Still, perhaps the incident was opportune. It had made him glance upward, and he caught sight of two cairns set close together. If he could reach them, he ought to be able to see his way more clearly. Was he hearing muffled voices up there? He hoped so, but he wasn't safe yet. The slope above him was steep. For a while he lost sight of the unknown summit. Only a glimpse of the cairns against the darkening sky kept him on course. Were they cairns, or figures sitting together? He stumbled forward, afraid to run in case he slipped. He fought off the memories. Yet, as he passed close to the next tree, he seemed to glimpse the hint of a face composed of cracks in the bark. Panic sent him scrambling upward. He clutched at roots which flaked, moist and chill. At last he scrambled up a slope to the edge of the trees. The sky was blackening. Against it loomed two hunched forms, heads turned to him. Joy seized him. He could hear voices. The sound was more than the muttering of wind. They must know their way down, and he could join them. He scrambled upward. The voices had ceased. Perhaps they'd heard him. But when he glanced up, the figures hadn't moved. A foot higher, and he saw that the faces turned to him were patches of moss. The figures were grey, composed roughly of fragments of slate. They were cairns after all. But it didn't matter. He had heard voices. He was sure that he'd heard them. Please let him have done so. Companionship waited at the summit. And indeed, as he struggled up the last yards of the slope, the two grey figures rose with a squeaking and rattling of slate and advanced heavily towards him.
That was Above the World by Ramsey Campbell, read by Sean Barrett. The producer was Mitch Raper.